Excited Utterance, the Evidence and Proof Podcast, Episode 163, Tomer Kenneth, in defense of factual precedents. Welcome to Excited Utterance. I'm your host, Ed Chang from Vanderbilt Law School. Excited Utterance is your podcast for cutting-edge scholarship and developments in the world of evidence. We bring virtual workshops to you throughout the academic year. This week, our guest is Tomer Kenneth. Tomer is a visiting assistant professor at USC's Gould School of Law, where his scholarship focuses on evidence, often from the perspective of legal and political theory. Tomer teaches evidence, as well as a course on judicial decision-making. Our podcast today features Tomer's new article, In Defense of Factual Precedents. In it, Tomer tackles the problem of general facts, facts that are common to multiple cases. These facts are unlike traditional adjudicative facts, such as what happened on March 10th at State and Main Streets. Instead, general facts are things like the reliability of a forensic method for Daubert purposes, or the social science facts that are often used in constitutional cases. They apply generally across the board and are relevant beyond the specific parties in a case. The problem with general facts is that they're general. Logic would suggest that courts should have some consistency regarding them from one case to the next. Inconsistency is not only potentially unfair to the parties, but calls the legitimacy of the legal system into doubt. But the question is, how do we achieve such consistency? And should courts consider the general facts that are found in other courts in other cases to be a sort of factual precedent? My conversation with Tomer frames this problem of general facts, explores some of the ways that courts might handle them, and considers the strengths and weaknesses of factual precedents. Tomer, delighted to have you on Excited Utterance. Welcome.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Your really interesting article focuses on these general facts, these facts that are common to multiple cases. And it's actually a problem that has bothered me for a long time, and I think appropriately so for someone who thinks about scientific evidence. But let me have you properly introduce the topic. So what are general facts, and why is it important to separate them for special treatment?
Right. Thanks. So the short answer is that general facts are these facts that have a broader scope. They transcend the specific circumstances of the parties and the case, which makes them relevant to many different cases. And this is also why I think they matter, and it matters that we think about them separately from specific facts or from adjudicative facts. So let me explain why I say that. So we have these adjudicative facts, facts like, did Tomer run the light last Tuesday night? And this kind of fact is relevant for probably a case involving a car accident that I was part of. It is unlikely that this sort of specific fact, adjudicative fact, will be relevant to many other cases. This is probably why we do not consider using facts that are determined in one case in another case. But as you correctly mentioned, I think there are many other kinds of facts which are general facts. So here are a few examples. In criminal law, we have general facts about recidivism rates. So the recidivism rates of older individuals are usually lower. This is a general fact. It applies to all cases in which courts have to decide something that has to do with older individuals' recidivism rates. And obviously, it applies to all cases in which older individuals are being tried. You can also have this idea in torts. So in torts, think of dangers of a particular toxin. So the fact that exposure to asbestos raises the risk of cancer. This kind of general fact applies to all sorts of cases that regard this specific dangerous toxin. You have general facts in constitutional cases. So these are sometimes called constitutional facts. So the effects of video games on children's brain development is one constitutional fact. And more recently, in constitutional cases, you have these historical facts, which are facts about history and tradition that animate the way we decide about legal norms. And probably most familiarly to our listeners, we have general facts in evidence. So we have general facts about the general acceptance, or maybe the consensus, of some scientific method. And we also have general facts about what juries know or do not know. So, for instance, whether the juries know or do not know about the traits of drug traffickers, courts have to decide this kind of question in order to decide whether to admit experts to tell the jury about the actions of drug traffickers. And this, obviously, is a general fact that applies to many cases.
So why is it important to separate these general facts from the usual adjudicative facts that we try in court?
So I think that the main reason why it's important to separate them is because the general facts are relevant for many other cases. So once you have a court that determines a general fact, other courts might perhaps use this kind of general fact. Imagine the following scenario. You have a court that is about to decide about the general fact, one of those that we discussed so far. This court then learns that another court previously has determined in a different case the same general fact. Then the question arises, what should this subsequent court do? How should the subsequent court relate to the prior court's decision? I think this question arises when we are thinking about general facts, but it does not arise when we are thinking about these specific or adjudicated facts simply because they are not relevant to many other cases.
Yeah, and there seems to be also a problem of consistency, right? It's not just what do we do with it, but it looks bad when one court decides a general fact in one direction and another court decides the same general fact in the other direction. It's all kind of part of the same legal system, and you would think that the legal system would at least get it straight. It's either A or B.
I absolutely agree. I think that once we start thinking about these general facts and the idea that they might be relevant to many different cases, we start to think about our intuitions with regards to how these different courts and cases should determine these general facts. And one strong intuition is this intuition of consistency, as you say, right? It's really weird if one court in Missouri, for instance, is going to determine that asbestos raises the risk of cancer, but another court in Montana is going to determine differently. There are, I think, importantly, also other intuitions that we might want to think about. It's not clear when you think about decision-making about facts that courts should rely on what other courts have done. First of all, it's not how we usually think about judicial decision-making. Second of all, there is something that seems important about litigants' ability to try their case, to argue the facts of their specific case, and that seemed to be in tension with this idea of consistency.
So I think it's implicit in our discussion so far, but just to be clear, how do courts currently treat generalized facts? And has there been any effort by them to think about them differently than the usual facts that we try at trial?
So that's an interesting question. It's actually a difficult one to answer. Why is that? Well, when you start, as I do, to look at the legal sources and try to see how different courts relate to these general facts, there is a methodological problem of actually finding out what the courts are doing. Why is there a methodological problem? Because the legal sources that we use, Westlaw, Nexis, and the likes, they do not index these kind of general facts. So we don't really have the trail of precedents that we really see in key sites or stuff like that in these areas. So what I did is basically I scanned a lot of case law and tried to find instances in which courts are discussing prior decisions by other courts. And I found many of them. So in all of the examples that I referred to earlier, I basically found subsequent courts determining these general facts and citing prior cases as if they are authorities for their own decision-making about fact. So importantly, both in the scholarship and in the case law, you have a quite strong resistance to the idea of using these prior cases. Both courts and scholars are saying that it could be a hollow ritual to basically cite prior cases, because the fact that a prior court has determined a fact does not tell us anything about whether this fact is accurate or not, allegedly, or at least this is the claim. So this is a bit about the practice. Now let's think about it analytically. Analytically, you have a subsequent court that is about to determine this general fact, and they know that there was a prior court decision that determined that same general fact. Now let's imagine that we're stepping into the mind of that subsequent court. What can it do? Well, we have basically three options. We can ask these subsequent courts to ignore the prior decision. Basically tell them, hey, you're not allowed to use the prior decision at all. Another option is to tell the subsequent court, hey, you're allowed to use this prior decision. Do it whenever you want. And probably they're going to do it when they are persuaded by it. So they're going to read the decision. If they like it, they're going to cite it. And if they will not like it, they will probably ignore it. Then a third option, the one that I'm trying to support in this paper, is requiring these subsequent courts to rely on the prior court's decision. That would be treating the prior court's decision as a factual precedent. It would require the subsequent court to take seriously the prior decision and to do something about it. It would not allow the subsequent court to simply ignore the prior court's decision.
Let me sharpen this discussion a little bit. All of the instances that you've raised so far, or at least in the most recent discussion here, is really about a court finding some fact, typically for a legal determination. And one way of thinking about general facts is not just when you have a general fact that's used for purposes of reaching a legal decision, but basically a general fact as a general matter. So you raised at the very beginning of our discussion about the toxicity of a substance. And in a toxic tort case, juries find general causation issues. So how does this get ported over to the jury context?
So what do we do with juries? A few answers to this question. First of all, I should caveat. My argument about factual precedence is mostly directed at decision-making by judges. So it mostly applies to appellate court cases, to trial cases in which we have bench trials, and to all these preliminary decisions by judges in jury trials, which we all know very well in evidence. In jury trials, when we think about factual precedence, I think they play out in at least two ways. So one way that they might play out is we might say, well, should the factual precedent itself bind the jury? So should we come up and say, hey, jury, here is a factual precedent. Now you have to follow it. I don't talk a lot about this in the paper. I think it's a very complicated question. There is a beginning of an answer to this question in the federal rules of evidence themselves that kind of distinguish between how juries should respond to judicial notice in civil trials and in criminal trials. This all, however, applies only to adjudicative facts rather than to legislative facts. All that to say that I'm kind of setting this aside and not really answering this direct question.
So it's fine that you want to focus on the judge-found facts, and I don't want to distract too much from the focus of your article, but I had a thought about the juries. It seems to me that you could apply the same ideas from your paper to juries without potentially running into the judicial notice or the jury trial right issues. For example, you could incorporate what is effectively factual precedent in a jury case by simply offering up the information to juries that a previous jury had found the fact in a certain direction, or that there were several other juries that found the fact in a particular direction. And then you might even push it forward in jury instructions by either more strongly wording things and suggesting that juries should normally follow what other juries have said, or in fact, formally creating some kind of presumption. That was kind of how I, in my mind, started to port it over to the jury context. Any thoughts?
Right. So I think this is a super interesting suggestion, which honestly, I didn't think a lot about. So on the theoretical level, I am inclined to think that you're right. So I'm inclined to think that there might be good reasons to come up and talk to juries and tell them, hey, we had prior decisions that have gone this specific way with this fact, or prior juries have decided this fact in this way. And you should probably know that. Maybe not only you should know that, probably take this into consideration. The one thing that is making me pause when we think about juries is that the whole idea of factual precedents seem to work a bit differently. Because part of the idea of factual precedents is to create this kind of discussion, explicit discussion, between different courts. So we have one court determining this fact and they're explaining why they determined this fact. And then other courts are going to use this prior case in order to determine their own facts. We don't really have that in jury decision making. We don't know why juries decided fact X rather than fact Y. In fact, in many of these general facts that we were talking about, we don't even always know what the juries thought about them. And in that sense, I think it's both theoretically and practically problematic to use factual precedents or general facts determined by one jury and kind of transferring them to another jury. Another practical issue, I guess, would be that we don't really know how juries decide and how juries deliberate about these issues. So I am in the camp that thinks that juries are actually quite good. I'm optimistic about juries. I think we should assume that they are a group of well-intentioned, intelligent people that are trying their best, and that means a lot. And that would lead to good outcomes in many cases. However, I also think that it's going to be hard for us in many cases to point out the instances in which juries did not follow the factual precedent that we wanted them to follow. And kind of an additional question or a next question down the line would be, well, if they don't do so, what do we do? I think these are all things that I need to think a bit more deeply about before I kind of embrace your idea of using factual precedents to the jury. There is, by the way, I think an old and really interesting paper by, I'm pretty sure it's Morgan, about jury notice that kind of talks about these issues.
So that's fair enough. And again, I didn't want to distract too far talking about juries. Let's go back to your article and talk about factual precedent for judges. In the article, you, of course, suggest that judges should treat previous case determinations as some kind of precedent. Tell us more about why you propose that and why you think that's the best way of approaching the problem.
Yeah, so what I am basically arguing for is what I call presumptive factual precedents. And presumptive factual precedents basically would require subsequent courts to engage with and consider the prior court's decision. However, the subsequent courts would not be required to follow the prior decision. That is, a subsequent court would be free to decide otherwise, but if they do so, they have to explain themselves. So why would we want to adopt these presumptive factual precedents? What I think that at the core of the case is the relationship that it creates between courts. So think about subsequent courts, for instance. Subsequent courts would now have to take into consideration the prior court's decisions about these general facts. They would really need to think about them deeply. And they would have to deliberate and engage with them. This really matters. Why does it matter? Because this deliberation and engagement helps us create better decision-making about facts. So on the one hand, when subsequent courts talk to other courts, they are engaging with the prior court's reasons, and they both project and also actually treat the subsequent courts as something of value. They show to themselves and to the entire community that the prior decisions by these prior courts is something of value. And I think that this sign of respect is really important as a way of promoting legitimacy in our system. It also promotes epistemically better outcomes. So when courts kind of learn from each other, they learn from each other's mistakes and they improve one another's decisions. And ongoingly, we have this collaborative decision-making by many courts. Rather than having one court trying to determine this general fact, we have many courts kind of working together and trying to answer these general facts, which are often quite difficult. So we're kind of aggregating all of these courts to work together, which I think has an epistemic benefit. We should also note that presumptive factual precedents will also have, I think, desirable ex-ante effects. So what are the desirable ex-ante effects? They would improve decision-making about general facts ex-ante. So knowing that their own decisions is going to be evaluated, scrutinized, and maybe criticized by future courts, each court that is about to determine a general fact is going to have more reasons to get at better answers, to provide more reasons to reach better outcomes. And that, I think, would, again, lead us to better epistemic outcomes.
One concern that I have about this, though, is that there's a lock-in factor that occurs when you start to worry about how the original determination or the first determination in the string of factual precedents will now create a presumption. So let me be a little more specific about that. If you have a defendant, defendants can always settle a case and not create any kind of precedent. So what's to prevent a defendant from waiting until you have a particularly weak case on a general fact, and then litigating that case then to establish a factual precedent that is in their favor?
A few things there. A, I absolutely agree with you that if we adopt my idea for presumptive factual precedents, it is going to lead litigants to make strategic decisions that they would not have done otherwise. And one of these decisions could be exactly the case that you were talking about. However, I'm not sure that it's such a bad thing. So let's run with the analysis that you offered. First of all, it's not clear to me that we actually have these weak cases. So notice that when we're talking about general facts, the general facts apply to all cases all the time, right? So it's not clear to me that it's going to be easier for a litigant to determine a general fact in one case rather than another case. But more importantly, at the core of my suggestion is this idea of presumptive factual precedents. That is, I do not argue that subsequent courts would have to follow the prior court's decision. Rather, the only thing that a subsequent court would have to do is to consider the decision and engage with it. Now, if there are good reasons to decide otherwise, the subsequent courts should simply decide otherwise. The subsequent court, in my ideal situation, would say, hey, we have this prior court decision. They held general fact X. I think that this general fact X is wrong. It is wrong for A, B, C reasons. And therefore, I determine general fact Y.
Final question for you. What's next for this project? I know that you're on the academic job market later this year. How does the project here fit into your broader research agenda?
Yeah, thanks. So I want to continue and explore the relationship between judicial decision-making about law and judicial decision-making about facts. And I think that this idea of factual precedent is a fertile ground for doing that. So one question that I'm thinking about is, what do we do about binding factual precedents? Should we ever have binding factual precedents? And if we do, how do we distinguish factual precedents and how do we change factual precedents? These are all questions that I think we need to solve if we take seriously the idea of factual precedents in our legal system. Another idea that I think we might want to think about a bit more deeply is, how do we take these ideas of factual precedents that are really arise from our understanding in evidence law and apply them to discussions that we are having now in constitutional law, specifically about historical facts? And there has been some writing done about that, but I think that the ideas about factual precedents and presumptive factual precedents can contribute to this line of reasoning. And finally, I also want to explore further the idea of judicial notice. So both judicial notice about general facts, I think there's a lot more to say about that. We can, and I think need, develop better guidelines for courts to tell them when they should discuss that. And how do we think of a judicial notice with regards to jury trial that you kind of mentioned before?
Well, Tomer, really enjoyed the opportunity to engage with you on this topic of general facts and the possibility of using factual precedents. Great having you on the show.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure.
As someone who has long been interested in scientific evidence, this problem of general facts has long fascinated me. The legal system has this elaborate apparatus of procedures and rules for taking evidence on case-specific adjudicative facts. As evidence scholars, this is in large part what we study. But once it comes to general facts, the wheels start to come off. As I teach in evidence class, when it comes to judicial notice of adjudicative facts, we have Rule 201. But when it comes to legislative facts, or general facts that are sometimes known as basic or non-evidence facts, pretty much all bets are off. And yet, the reception of general facts is super important to the legal system. This material is critical to both fact-finding and legal interpretation, and to leave it to largely unregulated processes with no sense of precedent or consistency seems neglectful, if not potentially unfair and delegitimizing. Tomer's article, along with Allison Orr Larson's article about a decade ago, and classic pieces like Monahan Walker's work on social frameworks, all of these articles are part of an important effort looking into how we should handle these general facts. It seems, though, that there remains a lot of work that is left to be done. For example, how much should we weigh factual precedent? And what role appellate courts should have on this matter, and how factual precedent might affect party incentives, are all things that are worth thinking more about. As I pushed Tomer during the interview, there also remains this rather unexplored issue of whether there should be the equivalent of factual precedent for juries. Now, this wouldn't be precedent per se, but shouldn't juries also know about the decisions that have come before? I'd bet that under existing case law, jury determinations in other cases, even if they were special verdict determinations, these determinations from other cases would normally be ruled irrelevant in a current case. But are they really irrelevant? And you might ask yourself, if you were on a jury deciding a general fact, wouldn't you want to know what other juries had previously found? And isn't it also delegitimating when one jury finds a general fact in one way and another jury finds the polar opposite? Think about what sometimes happens in toxic torts. In any event, my thanks to Tomer for pushing forward on this problem of general facts and factual precedent. I'm very much looking forward to seeing how his research agenda plays out in the years ahead. Support for Excited Utterance is generously provided by Vanderbilt Law School's Brandstetter Litigation and Dispute Resolution Program, as well as the Texas A&M University School of Law. The associate producer is Alex Nunn, and the production editor is Anirudh Marilla. Additional production assistance is provided by Lexi Creasy, and background music is provided by Kirsten Castle-Greer, Felix Wong, and Alex Crew. I'm your host, Ed Chang, and I hope you'll join us again next time when we take on another new work in the world of evidence and proof.